Hi guys, welcome to the Baggy Green Podcast. This is Ian speaking, and on this episode I'm joined once again by my good friend Matt. He joined me on the very last podcast we did where we spoke about Australia's World T20 campaign. And in this episode we're going to chat about the first test against Africa at the Gabba. So Matt, thanks again for putting some time aside to have a chat.
Not a problem, Ian. Thanks for having me again.
Cool, man. Well, let's jump right into it. All right. In the build-up to the first test, there was quite a bit of hype around the bowling attack from both our boys and then, of course, the Proteas as well. Now, looking back at the way the test kind of went about, it was definitely a game dominated by the batsmen. So, let's just say, what were your sort of feelings and thoughts going into the actual test match itself?
I thought Australia picked probably their best squad with Watson missing out during the injury. Yeah, I always thought Lyon was going to get a run at the Gabba, having done so well last year. I was actually quite surprised with South Africa's selection and picking Rory Kleiveld as their fourth seamer rather than going with Imran Tahir, as the Gabba is known to assist spinners on day four and day five. Our batting lineup with Quaney in there, I was quite excited to see. Watson is a big omission from the Australian test side, and it did give Quaney a chance to debut for Australia. I have a feeling he will be back or should be back for the Adelaide test, so Quaney might miss out then. So he might have to wait on another injury to get another go at the South Africans. But yeah, I felt we had picked our best squad, and I felt that South Africa, in their mind, had picked their best squad. They felt that Rory was going to do a better job than Imran Tahir on a Gabba wicket.
I guess another thing to consider is that JP Duminy, also with his injury that came about at the end of day one, that also put a span in the works for them. Given that he generally throws down a couple of overs for them, all of a sudden they were without him, and I guess they had to go to the brilliance of Graham Smith and Hashim Amla as part-time bowlers. So that probably set them back a little bit.
I would say that set them back quite a lot. I think they had counted on Duminy filling in for that role of a part-time spinner, and I think, yes, that must have set them back quite a bit.
Yeah, but when you got Graham Smith and Hashim Amla, I mean, why worry?
But yeah, they are top-quality bowlers. Hashim Amla did work within the 15 degrees, I'm sure. it was turning into 45 degrees at some stage.
Yeah, so if there's any Hashim Amla fans out there, we're sorry. But let's give credit where credit's due, all right? Now, we waffled on about the build-up to the test, so let's actually now have a little bit of a chat about how things came about with the first innings, which was definitely not easy going for our bowlers. So, Hashim Amla got himself another century, Jacques Cullis managed to score 147 runs.
Yeah, they batted really well. I think our bowling was a little bit to blame in that department. I think there was a lot of nerves on day one at a big test of the Gabba.
Yeah.
I think we bowled a little bit too short, as everyone has pointed out. They did bring it back together and they did bowl a bit fuller in the third day because the second day was rained out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think they did really well on the third day. They really struggled on the first day. I think it was a combination of nerves and just bowling that little bit too short, not getting the lengths quite right.
Another thing to point out, I guess, Matt, would also be the fact that I mean, we know the bowling was, it was a little bit flat. The guys maybe it was because they kind of had this expectation of, we're taking the number one side, we're trying to regain that title, and maybe push themselves a little bit too hard. But one can't forget that there was also a little bit of luck that went the South Africans' way. Hashim Amla was, Peter Siddle, when normally he would take these outstanding caught and bowled opportunities, he ended up grassing a pretty straightforward one when Hashim Amla returned one to him.
Yeah, for him that was put down quite an easy chance, I would say, for his skill level.
And again, unfortunately for Peter Siddle, he had a bit of luck go against him as well when he bowled a no ball when Jacques Cullis skied one up and the catch was taken, only for the umpires to say, sorry mate, you bowled a no ball. And this wasn't the first time we saw this test match. And we'll talk about the no balls a little bit later, but as well as this, the Amla and Cullis did to apply themselves, there was a little bit of luck on offer, and perhaps had those opportunities been taken, that may have been the difference between 450 runs versus 350 runs.
Uh, there are a lot of factors that are involved in test cricket, and luck has to be on your side to have a good day, and it was definitely on their side on day one.
Yeah, but fortunately for us, despite day two being rained out, the guys came back really, really well on that third day. I think it was a little bit depressing almost hearing the tone of a lot of supporters at the end of the first day saying, ah, geez, you know, here we go, long series, bowlers were useless, the fielding standards were poor, and basically writing the guys off before we'd even had a chance to bat. And the guys came back on the third day, all of a sudden they were bowling at fuller, they were rejuvenated, they looked fresh again, and they managed to rip through the South African middle order, and all of a sudden, you know, we were right back in the contest. I thought that was flipping awesome, and once again, you know, why get so negative when, you know, we haven't even had a chance to bat yet?
Yeah, no, it's the public is your number one critic. I like to say I'd like to see a full game before I start criticising players. And there's meant to be always two innings in a test match. So before I start criticising, I'd like to see both sides bat first and both sides bowl first. But it is disappointing that after one day at cricket, it angered me a little bit that, yeah, there were so many negative comments out there. I think what Papa's done with this side is a great thing, and yeah, it looks like it's going to continue on.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. You said, you know, it's always best to wait until two sides have batted. 565 runs right on the board there for the Baggy Greens, led by Michael Clarke himself. 259 runs not out. I mean, we've been so fortunate to see a guy take on an Australian side as captain and just take his game to a whole new level. I mean, if you look at, since the Sri Lankan series, he's managed to score 6 centuries. Of those, 2 of them were double centuries, 1 of them was a triple century. I mean, we're very fortunate that we've been able to see that. And I guess it's a testament for what's hopefully to come for the series. But once again, leading from the front, eh?
Yeah, it would have been nice to see if a couple of test matches could have gone for 6 or 7 days. It would have been nice to see how many runs he could have got. He looked like he was pretty much unstoppable out there.
And let's not forget, I mean, yeah, we spoke about Clarkey there. I mean, he was out there for, geez, over 300 odd minutes or something like that as he compiled that innings. But at the same time, one can't forget Ed Cowan. At the end of, what was that, at the end of play on day 3, when the when the media were talking with Ben Hilfenhaus, they were having a chat with him and saying, you know, do you think this is significant? And he was kind of saying, well, in his awkward sort of way, that, you know, I don't know. You know, you tell me whether it's going to be significant. And now looking back on it, it was definitely significant, because this is definitely a big step forward for Ed Cowan as an opener, and I guess just for the Baggy Greens, knowing that we've got a guy who really applied himself against an elite bowling unit.
Yeah, I think he knew he was under pressure. I think as a batsman in a national side, you have to score runs. That's your job to be there. The only way to stay there is by scoring runs, and he's mentioned that several times. And he did that. He really applied himself. He did a really, really good job. And it was you could see the relief on his face when he did score that 100. And then he went back to business. He didn't rest on scoring 100. Okay, he can get out now. He went back and kept batting with Michael Clarke.
Yeah, I mean, often guys getting their first centuries normally have a little bit of a concentration lapse. I mean, let's be honest. If there was one area of our batting, besides the issues with our top order not kind of coming right, you know, David Warner got out cheaply, Ricky Ponting definitely got out to something that he should have left, and which last summer he wasn't even touching those early on in his innings. But, you know, all these guys will come right. I mean, Rob Quiney just, you know, yeah, I think his dismissal was a little bit unfortunate, because, you know, he had kind of gotten off the mark with a pretty awesome shot as it was, you know, and it seemed that he came out backing himself. I hate saying that, but I mean, it is true. He came out knowing that he had to kind of stay true to how he is.
Yeah, he looked every bit of an international player, and I hope he has a long future. I hope he follows the steps of Michael Hussey.
Yeah, and I mean, let's not forget Huss, another guy, 3 centurions in our innings.
Yep, absolutely phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just great to see a lot of these guys coming right. I mean, also has hit a little bit of form for the Western Warriors going into this actual test match. But one area, if I was to kind of point, as I was trying to say a little bit earlier, if there was kind of one negative I could point out, the running between the wickets was a little bit all over the show. I think in Ed Cowan's case, in particular, was a lot of nerves. I mean, fair enough, a guy can be forgiven for that. And Michael Clarke works very hard in pushing the singles, making sure strikes, you know, you retain that strike, that you're alert, always looking for opportunities. And, you know, there were a few chances where they were a bit lucky. Even when Huss and Clarkey were going along together, they definitely pushed it. But that's, to me, that's a characteristic of, you know, our boys in Test cricket. It's not necessarily being aggressive with trying to find boundaries the whole time, but, you know, constantly on the go, looking for opportunities.
That can put real pressure on the bowlers, constantly changing the strike, constantly ticking over the scoreboard. I think we were scoring at about 4.5 by the end of the 4.5 runs per over by the end of the by the time we declared. And yeah, it was just, we were just really, really pushing it. And it wasn't all just boundaries, even though Wade had a bit of a flurry at the end there. It was just, yeah, pushing those singles, getting off strike, rotating strike.
And good for Matty Wade as well, because, I mean, Brad, as you and I were talking about before we started, you know, talking in this podcast, you know, Brad Haddin's just gotten himself a century for New South Wales. So I guess for Matthew, although he didn't have a lot of time at the crease, he definitely applied himself early on, got himself settled, and just played some lovely shots. And, you know, although he only got, what, it was 19 runs in the end, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that he came out, he played a role, and it was really good to see him go out and be able to express himself.
It looked as though Michael Clarke had a word to him and said, you've got 3 or 4 overs to set yourself, then we're going to have a bit of a flurry. And that's exactly what he did. And then, yeah, and then they chose the right time to declare, I think.
Yeah, I mean, well, we had a little bit of a lead on there, and it was always going to be about early wickets. It's kind of stupid to say that, because you always want early wickets. But in this sort of a case, with a lead of only 100-odd runs, you definitely wanted those early wickets. And the guys got there. You know, obviously Peterson was removed pretty early on, and then I guess we have to get back to the no ball issue, because we managed to get Hashim Amla when he chopped one on, and it was, unfortunately for James Pattinson, another no ball.
Yeah, we definitely have to talk about the no ball factor at the moment. It's crazy now that they're checking every wicket for a no ball. You've got to get your foot behind the line. It's as simple as that. I don't see a huge advantage in having your foot just that close to the line, or have it 10 centimetres back. I don't see how that can change the delivery of the ball that much. I'm no bowling coach, but yeah, I would like to see us, just so we know we're not going to bowl no balls, for them to start definitely stepping behind the line.
Yeah, but not only that, Matt, I mean, another thing to consider is just, okay, you bowl a wide, you're going to give away a run, you bowl a bouncer or one too many bouncers, let's just say in a limited overs game, eventually you're going to be given one for the over, you do it again, you're going to be no balled. When you bowl front foot no ball, limited overs cricket, you're giving away a free hit. In Test cricket, you're giving away a chance of what's the difference between possibly 100 runs and getting the guy out on the spot, as we saw. I reckon had, you know, Peter Siddle's, you know, not overstepped the line when Cullis was dismissed in the first innings, I think we would have seen the difference between 350 and 450 runs as in a team total. Basically, 100 runs is what we ended up being, you know, what ended up costing us. When, you know, Jacques Cullis was, you know, caught and the no ball was called. And I guess in the second innings, when James Pattinson managed to get the wicket of Hashim Amla, although Amla only went on to score 38 runs, you know, that could have just added that initial pressure that the guys had worked so hard to contain, or so hard to build up and trying to contain the South Africans. And, you know, it proved to be very costly, these no balls, in the greater scheme of things.
Yeah, if you were up against the umpire and the umpire was the one looking, you could possibly get away with it. But when you know they're checking it on a replay, there's no reason to even try and push it that much. It's going to be checked. There's no ands, ifs or buts. They're going to look at you. They're going to look at the delivery stride, and they're going to see if you stepped over the line or not. I think they need to pull it back an inch or two, and just to make sure their foot's behind the line now, because yeah, they're going to check it every time.
And I mean, look, 33 no balls for the match. That's pretty pathetic. And Alan Donald, I read an interview with him, and he was saying that we're very strict at practice and we police these things very well, all right? That's what he said about what goes on in this African camp. But it's clearly not really working in practice. And I mean, I know, you know, with the many test matches I've been to, you see the guys marking their run-ups, and, you know, it's quite a strategic process, and the guys spend quite a lot of time doing it, but I can't quite see how it's going to make sense. I mean, I remember playing cricket. You can measure your run-up a million times, but your stride's going to be different. It depends on your adrenaline levels. It depends on, you know, your levels of energy. There's many factors at play, but bottom line is you need to keep behind that line. And I still remember Ian Bishop and Michael Holding when I was watching one of the West Indies cricket series, and they were having a very good discussion about these no balls and saying that, you know, we're talking about two amazing test bowlers right here who said that they cannot understand why guys bowl so many no balls. You know, fast bowlers, it's the nature of being a fast bowler. Guys are always trying to push the limits. How fast can I bowl? How many times can I knock this guy in the, in the head? Many different things. Guys are always pushing themselves. How much swing can I get? Can I get the ball to, you know, can I find some reverse swing now? They're always pushing. So, but is it really worth trying to just push those extra few millimeters by that front line to, where's the advantage when it could mean the difference between getting a guy out for all your hard work and just being told, sorry, no ball, try again?
Yep, it's just not worth it anymore. That's the bottom line, and they need to teach that. They need to go back to training now, and they need to reassess their run-ups, basically.
Now, a lot of the guys listening might be hearing what we're talking about, agreeing with us, but saying, well, the umpire should also have a job to do. Why aren't they calling these no balls on the spot?
I think it's always been a bit hard on the umpire to have to look down at the delivery stride, and in 2 seconds as quick as the ball gets to the batsman, it's a fast bowler bowling at 140 kilometres an hour. I think it's always been quite hard on the umpire to call the no balls. I think it's actually a good thing that they've handed it over, well, at least on the wickets, handed it over to the third umpire.
But I guess the next question is, how many times are we missing no balls? How many times are no balls actually happening that are not being picked up? I mean,
I think it should be something that's policed. I think there should be someone there that has a camera. Well, they have a camera there all day, so it's not like they have to do anything else. Someone just needs to sit there and say, okay, that was a no ball. It shouldn't fall anything on the umpire. A no ball should not fall on the umpire at all. I think it should fall on a third umpire.
But I mean, not just that. I mean, the time it takes for guys to go ahead, do the reviews, you get the wicket, you know, we know that lovely feeling of adrenaline and that rush that we get when all of a sudden, and then all of a sudden, umpire saying, no, we just want to go upstairs. How many times did we see last time in the Border Gavaskar series? How many times, we're just going to go upstairs and check that. And look, when it's found out to be a no ball, it's legitimate. Peter Siddle overstepped the line. James Pattinson overstepped the line. It's nonsense. They shouldn't be doing that. But, you know, for umpires to now do this every single ball, it's going to take away a certain human element of, you know, just fanatics, getting that pure feeling of just total excitement and relief when you watch the bowlers build up that pressure and get the wicket, only to be told, no, sorry, it's a no ball. So that's why I guess, I mean, it's a human part of the game for umpires. They make errors, but it is their job.
Yeah, I can see that, but I've umpired a few games quite a few years ago, and it's a really hard thing to do. They get paid the big money, I guess, but still, I feel sorry for them.
Yeah, probably quite a big difference between coaching primary school cricket and umpiring primary school cricket and international cricket.
I've seen some young bowlers bowl quite fast. So.
Yeah, the 60 kilometres an hour must be quite difficult to check those no balls and then trying to judge that LBW, and, you know, I guess you call your mom to show the handy cam, you know, replay. Did he overstep the line?
Did he overstep by 4 feet? That's not much.
Okay, let's get back on topic here. but also, I mean, look, I think it's quite a cool topic to actually discuss, this whole situation, because there's no definite yes or no. But it's very good. It's good that umpires are doing it, though. But at the same time, hopefully, maybe it's the wake-up call players need to stop doing it. And hopefully the bowling coaches could say, all right, guys, let's sort this out now. I mean, Ben Hilfenhouse isn't doing it. I mean, okay, he didn't have the best test match, but, you know, a little bit of a pat on the back. At least he wasn't overstepping the line the whole time.
Yep.
Follow his book.
It's got to be, nothing's going to change in the rule books for the rest of this series, so it's got to be the players that are going to come back at the next test and show that they're not bowling no balls. It's got to be checked if they get a wicket, and that's that. If it's a no ball, it's a no ball. There's no wicket.
DRS. Used in some certain circumstances in the series, or should I say this test actually, we'll see how we go at the end of all three test matches, but it's kind of been used a bit odd. You know, the intention behind the DRS, to my understanding, was always to eliminate howlers and use it when, you know, there was a batsman knew that he had definitely got an inside edge and he shouldn't be given LBW. It can be referred, the decision can be reversed in the spirit of the game, not out. Now, all of a sudden, guys are using it as a little bit of a chance card, you know. What are your sort of thoughts on this? Because it does waste a lot of time.
When you're in the heat of battle and you're really trying to get that wicket, it's your choice. You've got two. If you waste them, they're gone. It's if you're wrong, they're gone. And there is a certain amount of leeway towards the umpire. Whatever's the umpire's decision, it's quite hard to be overturned. There has to be a certain margin of error. They have changed that. It is quite a lot bigger now. It has to be hitting the stumps more, I think over half the ball now. It does favour the umpire's decision a lot more now. So you have to be certain that you have got the person out or not got the person out. But it is. You've only got two of them. It's not like you can review every second ball. it's up to the team when they use it.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think we're going to be able to talk about it a bit more because there's definitely going to be. You know, it's going to be used a lot more in the series, and you know, let's just see how things go from there. But all in all, looking back at the test from day one, all of a sudden to looking at how things ended up, the Baggy Greens are going down to Adelaide with momentum. I mean, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, both captains said at the end of today that no real team has the advantage going down to Adelaide, but I have the feeling that Australia is definitely on top. And I really hope that it does show when they step out in Adelaide. The batting was absolutely phenomenal, and to get five wickets out today when you could see they were just trying to bat out the day, it gave me hope.
I think there's going to be a little bit of talk now about the squad balance going down to the Adelaide Oval. In my mind, I don't think we should be playing around with things too much. Ricky Ponting. Yeah, he was gone for a duck, but let's keep in mind that, you know, the Sheffield Shield hasn't been producing the best batting performances, but by the same token, a lot of players have said, even Ed Cowan said after his own century, that it's been very difficult to score runs. You know, and Punter was top of the Sheffield Shield run tally chart. So, I'm not going to rule him out yet. I think there's always going to be that criticism of Punter because he's getting on in years, so to speak. But you know, he could come right. David Warner could also come right. I just think David Warner had insufficient practice. I mean, even in the Champions League, he was kind of just, you know, hanging about on the sidelines. They're not really doing a great deal. And Rob Quiney, you know, I don't know if Shane Watson's going to be ready for the Adelaide Oval. And, you know, he deserves his chance because he proved himself last season. I see no reason to really go playing around too much with anything.
No, not at all. You would put in Shane if he is fit. If he is ready to bat and bowl.
Yeah, but he has to be ready for both. I mean,
yeah, there's no point putting him in as a batsman. I think Quiney's as good as a batsman as Watson is, and I think he adds a little bit to the team in that regard. Where if Watson's fit, then you have to put him in any squad in the world. He's absolutely phenomenal batsman and bowler, and it will help with the bowling lineup with Lyon definitely playing in Adelaide.
Oh, his home conditions, he's going to be in front of his home crowd. And I think the one area maybe looked at, I don't think it's necessarily fair because I think he did a lot better in the second innings and towards the end of the first innings. But Ben Hilfenhaus is probably the guy who's a little bit under the microscope at the moment. You reckon that Hilfie should be given a run at the Adelaide Oval?
Well, there has been some chat on around. I've talked to a few people today that they're thinking that Hilfie might be the one that gets the. That gets the axe for the poor first inning bowling performance. I would feel a little bit sad in that regard, although we do have Mitchell Starc, who has been in quite phenomenal form as of late. Starc does have a Shield match between now and the next test, so he could honestly pick himself if he has a really good game in that Shield game.
All in all, though, not really too worried if we don't change things too much, eh?
No, not at all. No, I'd be happy with Hilfenhaus or Starc. It wouldn't worry me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited to see how that goes. I mean, also, you have a look at the moment. The South Africans seem to be doing things a little bit oddly. Gary Kirsten's going back off to Cape Town for a few nights to see his family. A couple of the players from their squad are staying up in Brisbane. Some guys are going down to South Australia in the meantime. It's good for guys to have a break, I guess, and clear their heads. But perhaps they may just be opening a little bit of a wound here.
I think after a tough, well, 4 days of cricket like that, I find it a little bit odd that they're all going, shipping off all over the different places, going to the Gold Reef and stuff like that. It, obviously, you don't live and breathe cricket 24 hours a day, and they get a few days off, but I would still be thinking more of a team unity thing rather than all splitting up and going your different ways.
Yeah, I mean, also knowing the type of mentality Michael Clarke's been having lately as a guy who believes that, well, he's extremely optimistic, but he believes that the team can win from any situation. And no doubt that the guys are going to be going down to, you know, Adelaide, and they're going to be working their asses off, making sure that they're ready for this test. And yep, this is definitely going to be something that they may, psychologically, they may smell a little bit of an opportunity here to get one up on the podiums in terms of the actual preparations for the game. And as you said, unity is a big part of this.
Yeah, we've seen that in the England dressing room lately. They're having a little bit of a problem with the unity there. It's always been a big part of Australian cricket. It's always been based around a very tight team unity, and that's how I believe you dominate Test cricket for 10 years is a lot with team unity.
And let's just hope Michael Clarke's era's begun. Well, it certainly has. It's been very exciting and very, very inspiring. At your personally, I found it very inspiring to see what's happened. I know a lot of people have been critical of the way things have gone, but I'm really proud of the boys. And although we didn't get the win, we wanted the win. I woke up this morning and really believing that we were going to take the game. Unfortunately, we didn't. But we go down to Adelaide Oval with lots of positives. And I don't know about you, but I'm really excited for the battle. But, you know, the Proteas, it doesn't change the fact that they're still a brilliant side, and it's going to be hard work.
I was a little bit disappointed that Clarke called off the game with 10 overs left. I had a feeling we could have got a hat-trick in the next 2 overs. I know we would have lost 2 overs to change over the batting, but I think if we sent out Warner and another big hitter, we could have chased down that total quite quickly. I'm a very optimistic Australian supporter, so yeah, I would have liked to have seen us play out the rest of the day.
but again, I mean, I think it's important. One thing I hope that a lot of fanatics out there have learned is that, you know, you've always got to maintain your pride and your belief in the baggy greens. Shane Warne always believed that Australia could win from anything, and that's something that we need to maintain now, especially with a guy like Michael Clarke leading the side, who wants to make all the supporters proud and just do the best job possible. And we saw, day one, things did not go well. We missed a lot of opportunities, made life hard for ourselves, and we still came out managing to rattle the opposition a little bit. So I've got a lot of confidence going down to the Adelaide Oval, and I can't wait for the next test.
No, oh, me too. Yeah, 13 days away is too long. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, all of you guys listening to this podcast, thanks a million. Thanks for hearing us talk about the game itself and go off track a little bit. But hopefully some articles will be up in the next few days. If you want to have a little bit of a say about what we chatted about, go follow the Baggy Green blog on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter. It's at Ian Baggy Green. Matt's also on Twitter. What's your Twitter account again?
Oh, I don't even know. I think it's Matt_McCracken.
That's it, something like that. Don't worry, we'll put all in the podcast over here. But thanks guys for listening. Hope you're all feeling a little bit better after the way things end up for the Baggy Greens. And for myself and Matt, thanks for listening. It's always awesome to have you guys, you know, put aside some time and listen to these podcasts. And yeah, go Baggy Greens and bring on the second test.